Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. As Americans mark the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in New York City, a suicide bomber blew up a truck at a NATO combat outpost in Afghanistan. The base serves U.S. Special Forces. The Army reported 89 soldiers wounded. Two Afghan civilians were killed, including a three-year-old child. In the next 48 hours, Kabul exploded with a series of bombings and ground attacks, gunmen appearing to be linked to the Taliban's Haqqani network with suspected al-Qaeda ties, appear responsible for breaking through to top security zones around NATO and the U.S. Embassy.
Even the American military itself and the American intelligentsia doesn't completely understand what it was up against when it went in there in 2001.
Two experts on Afghanistan, Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, join us. They're authors of the book Crossing Zero, and we began by discussing their latest report titled 9/11, Psychological Warfare and the American Narrative. Although we spoke with them before the U.S. Embassy in Kabul came under fire, Paul Fitzgerald coincidentally bringing up events there in 1979 that heralded a new U.S. policy of supporting Afghan warlords and power brokers in a fight against the Russians in Afghanistan, this perpetuating the U.S. Cold War era.
1979, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, we were in the middle of this production for my TV show. We had interviewed Paul Warnke and John Galbraith about this crowd of people who were, you know, banging on the gates and saying, no, 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 you can't talk to the Russians. You can't talk to them. They're duping you. Anybody who talks to them is a dupe. This kind of went on and on. And, of course, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, they came forward and said, see, we told you so. They're aggressive. They're expansive. They're moving towards the Middle East. And we wondered at the time. We noticed how the entire issue regarding SALT, Carter immediately put off the SALT II negotiations, the ratification that was going on in the Senate. He asked the Senate not to even discuss it. And we wondered, where did this come from? How did we suddenly, with this one event, wind up in the middle of this issue? I mean, it was just tailor-made. It was made to order. It was like, wait, this is just too good to be true.
Our conversation quickly turned to America's Cold War elite and how invested they had been in Afghanistan, especially former CIA Director William Casey, who was mentioned in a book by a recent Talk Nation radio guest, Edward Girardet. Much like Gould and Fitzgerald, Edward Girardet has been reporting from Afghanistan long enough to know that the real story is the untold one, and that often the reverse of what we're told in America turns out to be the reality on the ground in Afghanistan. In Girardet's book Killing the Cranes, Casey tells the reporter how naive he is, and that Casey is in fact supporting the notoriously violent warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and not the less violent Massoud, a leader who had far more diverse backing within Afghan society.
The Hekmatyar connection with the United States had been developed early in the 1970s. The United States had competed peacefully with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The Afghans had actually been under the control of the British. They had been independent since 1919, but they were something of a protectorate from the British Empire. They had had played Britain off against Russia during the imperial era, and they were doing the same thing during the Cold War era. They were playing the United States off the Soviet Union. And so there was, if you read the cables, this is one of the things that we get into in our first book, if you go back into the history and you read the cables and the transmissions and the discussions between American diplomats in the 1940s, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, and even into the Nixon era, you see these comments from secretaries of state and from intelligence people who are basically saying, we're not going to let those pesky Afghans do to us what they did to the British. We're not that naive. We're not going to be the British when we run this thing. We're going to do it differently. So picking up on Hekmatyar, in 1973, Mohammed Daoud overthrew the king and established a republic. And he did it with a faction of the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, which were labeled as communists by the United States. You know, once again, this is a subtlety. What the United States labeled communists during the 1950s and 60s was like anybody who wasn't going along with the idea of free market capitalism in free enterprise was labeled a communist, whether you were a nationalist or whether you were a socialist or whether you were a social democrat or whether you were a tried and true Marxist-Leninist, okay? So this is what was going on, and that's what happened in 1973. Mohammed Daoud, the cousin of the king, he had run the country as the prime minister up until 1963, and he was a hard-nosed nationalist Afghan. He knew how to bargain, and he knew how to play the United States off against the Soviet Union. So when he came back on the scene and overthrew the king in 1973, that set off alarm bells. The first cable that the U.S. ambassador sends to Washington is he says, we're back in the great game again. We got to get geared up towards this thing. And that was when Hekmatyar came on the scene. He and Massoud were friends during that time period. They'd been friends at Kabul University. And Hekmatyar comes in, and Hekmatyar is a radical Islamist. He turns out to be the biggest drug dealer. He turns out to be this hard-nosed businessman. And that's how these operations are financed. You know, the CIA doesn't have to do it. They'll let a guy like him do it. He does all the dirty work for them, and they just wash their hands of it and say, well, what can we do? We can't control a guy like that. This is the way the system really works. And unfortunately, I don't think Americans really have a, you know, we have a kind of James Bond idea of image of the way these things are done, and it's really not. You know, intelligence work in this sort of thing, overthrowing countries and assassinating leaders and undermining dictatorships and things like that, it's in very dirty business.
Hekmatyar left Afghanistan actually after a murder incident that he was charged with murder, put in jail actually, and released after the coup that removed King Zahir Shah. And he went over and basically began working with Pakistani intelligence. And at that point, and Massoud actually was part of this too, and at that point, what really began happening was the beginning of the attempt to try to destabilize the Daoud government. And this is how far back the U.S. involvement in destabilizing Afghanistan really goes. So when you really look at the choice of Hekmatyar by Casey, this is absolutely, you know, not surprising. In fact, Representative Charlie Wilson absolutely embraced Hekmatyar and made sure he got the largest chunk of the money coming in from the United States. He was chosen by President Zia. You know, this is certainly all part of the backstory about the various interests that were really at play here, and what Hekmatyar was servicing had little to do with the actual needs of Afghanistan. Then when you come up to, you know, the mid-90s, when Hekmatyar was the star who was supposed to take over Afghanistan, and in preparation for the possibility he couldn't, the Taliban suddenly emerges out of Pakistani ISI's attempt to organize. And these are all the processes that have gone on, you know, for all these decades. And here we are once again. Hekmatyar comes in with the same kind of power, but yet when you really look at what he has contributed to Afghanistan, it is really literally, it was actually from the bombing of Kabul happened after the Soviet withdrawal and Najibullah's government went down after 3 years. It would have been, you know, 94 to 96. The bombing of Kabul was between Hekmatyar and Massoud, and they destroyed Kabul in their effort to try and take over, which they couldn't. And that's how you ended up with eventually the Taliban coming in, orchestrated by Pakistan.
Well, I mean, there was an overt position by the United States to take an ultra-conservative approach towards the situation after the Soviets left. The United States did not want any remnant left of socialism or the socialist PDPA in the country. And recall the fact, this is an important fact, that everyone predicted all through the 1980s, they said, well, the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, have no support whatsoever. Socialism is just not going to be accepted. There's not going to be any progressive government in there. We're going to establish a religious government. We're going to help them, the Afghans, establish a religious government. And what happens is that the Soviets withdraw, and the Afghan government holds out 4 years. It holds out from 1989 until 1992. And they did have indigenous support. In fact, even when the United States went in there in 2001, who were the people that they need in order to run the bureaucracy to staff the ministries? They have to go back to all the PDPA people who were running it from 1978 until 1992. And this is where we come in. The American people have had such a narrow, anemic narrative about what Afghanistan was all about, what its involvement was, that even the American military itself and the American intelligentsia doesn't completely understand what it was up against when it went in there in 2001. and neglected it after 2001 completely. We were there in 2002, shortly after the bombings by the United States. And we had guys, we talked to, as you mentioned, Edward Girardet, we talked to the Time correspondent. He was one of these people who had, you know, walked over the mountains with the Mujahideen during the mid-80s. And he's scratching his head saying, I don't get it. I don't get what the U.S. is doing here. And this was a guy who was very well connected to the intelligence, the American intelligence community. He said, I talk to people, aid people who come back from these various provinces. He says, I talked to an aid person who came back from Kandahar last night, and she said that, you know, the Pakistani ISI is openly recruiting for Al-Qaeda in the villages around Kandahar. You know, how does that happen? He says, we should know about that stuff. He says, we have all the capabilities, the intelligence capabilities to be able to put a stop to that. He says, I cannot understand why this is happening. So, you know, it's very curious. You know, the way we used to look at the Soviet Union as being monolithic, it wasn't monolithic. Well, I think when you look at our own government as being monolithic, the United States, okay, it isn't monolithic. In fact, since the Reagan era, so much of the stuff that goes on in the name of the United States has been privatized and personalized, including our foreign policy, that things are done and deals are cut that the government of the United States doesn't even comprehend.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, and we're speaking with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, authors of the book Crossing Zero, and we've been focusing on their recent report, 9/11, Psychological Warfare and the American Narrative, as well as their May report, Restoring Afghanistan's Tribal Balance. It was written by Khalil Nouri, Gould and Fitzgerald, and Michael Hughes. And we asked where this new level of violence is leading us and if the U.S. might now expand the air war and their use of drones.
Part of the problem with this whole drone war is that the fundamental assumptions about the effectiveness of what they're doing has never been discussed. There's never any open debate about this, okay? The fundamental assumptions is that, you know, by taking out the leadership, this is basically command and control stuff. This is the stuff that, you know, the RAND people developed during the 1950s and 1960s to take out the Soviet leadership. I think there was a guy here in Boston, Charles Stark Draper from Draper Labs. Boston's heavily into the military-industrial area, not just the think tank people, but also the manufacturing of these ideas and these mechanisms. He says, with enough time and money, I can put a missile through Khrushchev's bathroom window. It's the whole idea behind that is that if we can decapitate, if the United States can decapitate the leadership, then the rest of the people will embrace freedom and come over to our side. So that's the basic assumption behind this whole predator war. I mean, the development of these individual instruments like the predator drones, which are flown from air bases in Arizona and also from an air base in Florida. Somebody said that one general had to come off the golf course one day and walk next door and discuss some kind of attack on some militant in Afghanistan. This is the kind of detachment that they're living with. And the fact is that the fundamental questions about whether these things are effective or not are never even asked. Our media doesn't do it. Our politicians don't do it. Our government officials, our legislature is completely beholden to our military for the intelligence on what to do and how to do this. And our military, which has a vested interest, of course, in these predator drones, and our military-industrial complex, which has a vested interest in seeing that these things work as effective tools of foreign policy, just simply say, oh, well, this is what we do now. We're going to keep doing this. It's too expensive to put boots on the ground. It's too expensive to build nations. It's too expensive to put the diplomats there to train them to do all these different things. Not only that, in truth, it's too messy. It's not what the United States does. Okay, the United States basically in World War II, you know, carpet bombed and firebombed the cities of Japan and Germany. That was the inheritance. RAND was a think tank from the United States Air Force. I believe it was Douglas Aircraft that was paid for it originally. The thinkers of RAND, the intelligentsia that have basically populated American foreign policy since World War II, into Korea, into Vietnam as an example, now into the 21st century with this predator warfare are people who their background is from World War II and the application of technological solutions to human problems. There's this wonderful article that I came across that was written in 1972 by J. William Fulbright, who was at the time a majority leader in the Senate Foreign Relations. He basically took the position that we never actually looked at when we created the Cold War in 1947, when the Truman Doctrine was announced. that we never really questioned the assumptions by which this whole national security state was created. These are very important assumptions, and he basically wrote this very brilliant article, which you can access on the New Yorker website. It's called Reflections in Thrall to Fear, and he articulates it beautifully, the thinking that went into the creation of the national security state, and also the devastation that Vietnam had wrought to the intelligentsia that had created that. They had really found themselves in a dead end. And that's what was so important about what was going on in the 1970s to what is going on today. Instead of dealing with that intellectual bankruptcy that was the foundation of the Cold War, instead of dealing with that, that had produced Vietnam, instead, a small group of people decided to give the Russians their own intellectual crisis in a place called Afghanistan. And that was a foregone conclusion. We had a triumphalist narrative that was absolutely devastated, a triumphalist narrative of World War II, where the United States had gone into Europe and rescued freedom, and freedom, nothing less than freedom. Here, that triumphalist narrative, we were going to go in Vietnam and give these people, quote, freedom. And if you look at all the documentation from the 1950s and 1960s about what our policy people were doing, was they were inspired by this idea of bringing freedom, laissez-faire capitalism, okay? But you get into the 1970s, and this group of people, otherwise known as Team B, decide that they're going to give the Soviet Union their dysfunctional crisis in a place called Afghanistan. We're not going to address our problems. This psychological issue that we're dealing with here that created our problem, that created Vietnam, that created the national security state, we're going to give them the same problem we have, the same psychosis. And that's where we are today. We have spoken with military people, intelligence people in our own establishment, and they realize they don't know what they're doing any longer because they're lost in the mirror. They believe their own Charlie Wilson's war, their own triumphalist narrative. The triumphalist narrative of the Soviets from World War II got them into Afghanistan, motivated them, and kept them there. And so what happened is that their generals, their hawks in the Soviet Union, didn't want to lose a war. They couldn't believe they could lose a war. They had beaten the Germans during World War II. They were certainly going to beat these Afghans coming over the border from Pakistan, okay? The fact was is that they were being played. They had been set up to do this. Now we're dealing with a situation where our own people, our own intelligence people, are admitting that they're clueless when it comes to what a solution is here, because they've been inside the mirror so long that coming down to a ground truth is virtually impossible to do. The fact is that the money isn't there any longer. The United States no longer has the kind of economy that can support the kind of war that we waged during World War II or that we waged during Vietnam. It's very expensive to do this kind of thing, and the United States economy, everybody knows, is in a position where there's a lot of political discontent growing.
You wrote, quote, according to the official narrative, 9/11 was an attack on everything American, and in so doing, changed everything about America, like Kafkaesque characters who'd suddenly found themselves on the other side of a Cold War Iron Curtain mirror. Americans would now have to watch what they say and watch what they do, open up to questioning, or face jail when prodded by squinty-eyed border guards and forsake any hope of privacy or dignity in a new world of electronic spies and full body scans. And you say further down the page that what's not easy to see is how a long-standing campaign of covert psychological warfare, built up since the early days of World War II, had made the slow destruction of American democracy and the ascension of rule by secrecy inevitable long before the planes ever left the runway on 9/11.
I think the function of psychological warfare, which clearly has been the process used going back actively post-World War II to basically set the American people up to continually be flooded with a fear-based view of the world, and that we hold the freedom and we have to protect it. And the sense that it worked when it was outside maintained that illusion. But when 9/11 hit, it shattered the illusion. And that's where we are right now. But in terms of where we're going, when they say no boots on the ground, they do not mean there will be no military operations. There will be plenty of military operations, but they will be covert. They will be handled by Navy SEALs. They will be handled by all kinds of black projects.
So and private companies.
Private
like black,
companies and
black
all of that. Exactly. So what we're really looking at is the total, complete, covert war of the world. And by the way, we're already seeing the use of predator drones in this country.
You know, there's a ground reality here that we simply are not aware of. And we became aware of aspects of it in our dealings as journalists in the Soviet Union, as an example. We were there in 1987. And I remember one of these guides that we were with shook her head, this young woman who was working for Boris Yeltsin. She said, you know, we get people from all over the world who come to visit here. We get people from communist countries, but we also get people from non-communist countries. And the only people who tell us that they are the freest and that they are free are the Americans. And as far as we're concerned, you're the most conformist of all the people that come in from all over the world. You're afraid to have your own opinion. I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, a front page article in the Washington Post just last week was quite shocking, really. It was a quote. It was part of their series on the intelligence, the massive amount of intelligence that's going on, and especially since 9/11, with Homeland Security. And it was a quote, I believe, from a Navy SEAL. And he said something to the effect of, we are dark matter. We step out of the dark and give order to the universe. That should be a frightening thought to any American, that we have this whole dark thing going on out there, of which the people in the dark are very well aware of, okay, of what they're doing, manipulating, overseeing political movements, eavesdropping, spying on everybody's activities, you know, not just checking you at the airport, but checking into your background whenever they care to, for whatever reasons possible, the surveillance, the omniscient surveillance that's been going on. And that's what 9/11 was about. 9/11 was somebody stepped in out of the dark and did that. And in the Soviet Union, you had the overt controls. They were very mechanical. They were very mechanistic. You knew you were being watched. Everybody you talked to, would they just simply whisper and say, don't talk about that here, okay? Well, that's now happening here.
In fact, I think Paul's point about the fact that what 9/11 did is it literally brought home the ability to turn the United States into a police state. And that is one of the greatest acts of psychological warfare we've ever seen, whoever the ultimate perpetrator turns out to be. And when you consider the events going on now in Afghanistan, there's always an underlying agenda in terms of the purpose. What we've discovered over and over again is, for instance, the Taliban as an example. They always emerge no matter what, no matter how many times it's revealed that the Taliban is a creation of Pakistani intelligence, that it's not an indigenous Afghan force, that it doesn't represent anything close to any kind of Islamic experience that Afghans have had historically, that this is really an aberration that is being perpetrated by the mainstream media, and they're constantly brought back. In the 1990s, the Clinton administration was aggressively trying to recognize the Taliban. They were trying to set up the Taliban so they could get their UNICAL deal in there. And so once again, you hear the constant talk about the Taliban, the Taliban. So right now, you know, one possible scenario is, in order to really hasten the shift from, you know, whatever the political agenda is, from the negotiation process or to remove, again, the boots on the ground, they want to cut their deal, certainly with Karzai at this point, in terms of being able to maintain a presence in Afghanistan. But again, a presence that would be very different than the kind of presence that we have now, as you point out. When you have American soldiers that are recognized and their families are here and everybody knows about it, that produces a different kind of response than when you have a completely covert operation going on there. And the inclusion of the Taliban in the government has always been one of the main objectives, to get the Taliban in there.
We have spoken with Americans who have come back, both military and diplomatic, who've come back from Afghanistan, and they are very confused over what exactly the policy is coming out of Washington. Are we supposed to be aligned with the Taliban, or are we supposed to be fighting the Taliban? Are we supposed to be eradicating terrorism, or working towards implanting them in the government? And that is a part of the failure of what's going on right now, and it's putting our own people in harm's way. There's no question about that, because the signal that is being sent to the Afghan people is not clear. The signal that's being sent to our own people is not clear. They don't know what their job is. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing. It's a very complex situation, and they simply don't have the tools or the background to understand the whole situation fully, which is why we've been asked to speak to them to try to give them some perspective on what's been going on. And we've come after the two books that we've written about that and our 30 years of experience. Our conviction is that the American establishment that puts their people overseas has been on the other side of the mirror for so long, it no longer knows what the ground truth is. It no longer knows what the reality is, and that is hampering its own mission. And, you know, there's not enough money in the world to make what they're doing work. And I think they have run out of money. And I think what we're seeing right now in the domestic political situation is there's just this enormous amount of confusion regarding how to go about doing things. Whatever we are, we need to have a national discussion of what the future is of the United States and what we're going to become as a democracy, because certainly the dark forces have taken over since 2011 and used it for their advantage, and that's got to be addressed in terms of where we're going and what we're doing, because in many, many ways we have become a very different country than we were, and people are beginning to express that, as I said, you know, that the various articles that are appearing right now. But here's one right here from the Telegraph. Post-9/11 America has become the land of the fearful. Here's another one from The Nation magazine, The New American Jiu-Jitsu, in which the author basically says that we've used our own strength and power against our own principle and purpose of what we are as a nation. Here's another one from The Washington Post, An America That No Longer Knows Itself, by Kathleen Parker. This has to be addressed, and it's a psychological issue. You know, perhaps instead of, you know, reinforcing our soldiers, we should send, you know, 15,000 psychiatrists down to Washington and, you know, try to get a handle on what exactly is going on here.
Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, finally, what about the media? How would you make improvements there in what is obviously a vital part of all of this?
I think that the breaking down of the hypnotic effect of the psychological warfare campaign that has kept Americans completely cocooned in this sort of Cold War thinking, the assumptions of Cold War being the foundation of everything we did, certainly when it came to foreign policy, and how that ultimately turned into, when the Soviets crossed the border into Afghanistan, into a permanent war economy. And that's really what we've been living in. So I really see at this point that these realities are seeping in everywhere. I think Paul just read the headlines of, you know, four different mainstream newspapers where people are definitely raising the question. They may not be at the level of questioning that we certainly provide in terms of the true origins of how the Soviets got into Afghanistan, which obviously supports the fundamental position of Senator Fulbright questioning the Cold War and the assumptions about the Cold War and Afghanistan and how the Soviets got in is a perfect example. And the role the media played in the 1980s in creating that narrative was very active and very supportive of maintaining the narrative that is beautifully summarized in Charlie Wilson's War, which was the propaganda story created to fool the American people into basically supporting the foreign policy decisions that were going on in the 1980s.
And we must not forget the fact that this intelligentsia that had created the Cold War completely broke down during the Vietnam War. And instead of actually addressing that, we took it one step further. These people took it one step further and said, no, we weren't wrong. If the product of the policy was wrong, then we'll just throw the policy out because we're going to do what we're going to do. And that's how we wound up where we are today. And it's the supreme irony of it is that this is occurring as a direct result of the same thing in the same place in Afghanistan that it was done to the Soviet Union. So it's like a mirror image of their own policy.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald are authors of the book Crossing Zero. We've been focusing also on their recent report, 9/11, Psychological Warfare and the American Narrative. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in stores and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.